The headlines. Armenia's prime minister accuses the armed forces of an attempted military coup and calls on his supporters to take to the streets. The militaries of India and Pakistan agreed to stop firing on the disputed border in Kashmir after years of tensions between the two members. And also, China slams the U.S. for undermining regional peace and stability after the American Navy warship sailed through the Taiwan Strait. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan has warned of an attempted coup against his government by the country's armed forces. Pashinyan says a statement by the army calling for him to resign amounts to a coup attempt. He has asked his supporters to gather in the center of the capital, Yerevan. Pashinyan has also fired the head of general staff of armed forces, that after the armed forces issued a statement calling for the resignation of the government. Pashinyan has faced calls to resign for months over what critics call his disastrous handling of a conflict with Azerbaijan over the dispute in Nagorno-Karabakh region last year. The six-week conflict pitted Armenian forces against Azerbaijanis. The fighting resulted in ethnic Armenians losing swaths of territory. The Indian and Pakistani armies have agreed to bring a halt to cross-border firing on the disputed border in Kashmir. The agreement was reached between the military operational heads of the two countries during a phone call. They also agreed to discuss bilateral concerns that could disturb peace and lead to violence in the Himalayan region. Exchange of gunfire has frequently happened along the line of control in recent months. India and Pakistan controlled parts of the contested Kashmir region, but both claim it in full. They fought two wars over the mountainous territory. Well, for more on that, we're joined by our correspondent, Kamran Yusuf, who's with us from the Pakistani capital, Islamabad. Kamran, tell us more about this agreement.
Well, this agreement came after the top military commanders of India and Pakistan spoke on telephone. And after that, both countries issued a joint statement stating that they have agreed to restore the ceasefire along the line of control, a de facto border that divides Kashmir between India and Pakistan. Remember, relations between the two countries have been tense over the past many years, particularly after a terrorist attack in Indian-controlled Kashmir in February 2019. And since then, the two countries have continued to exchange fire along the line of control, causing casualties on both sides of the line of control. But this development is certainly seen as significant, as both countries agreed now to halt such hostilities. The big question, however, remains if this latest step will lead to further de-escalation and resumption of dialogue between the two countries.
Kamran, there was also issues regarding agreements basically made on bilateral concerns that could disturb peace and lead to violence in the Himalayan region. What are those bilateral concerns that both sides could be worried about, and how can that these hurdles and impediments be removed?
Well, it is an open secret that the major issue or bilateral issue between India and Pakistan is the long-standing dispute over Jammu and Kashmir. Both countries have fought three wars. They held several rounds of talks to resolve this dispute, but they could not break the deadlock. So Kashmir is the main point of contention here. At the moment, the joint statement that we have seen, they actually pointed out the misunderstanding at the line of control or in the border areas. So they talked about those mechanisms to sort out those issues. But when it comes to addressing the larger question of Kashmir, there is no indication if there are any talks between the two countries to resume anytime soon. However, because of these steps, the agreement on restoring the ceasefire can create a positive atmosphere that would eventually compel both countries to sit across the table and discuss all the bilateral issues, including the issue of Jammu and Kashmir.
All right, thanks a lot, Kamran Yusuf, a correspondent joining us from Islamabad. Anti-coup protesters have held new rallies in Myanmar despite a heavy security presence across the country.
Debate, debate.
People hit the streets in the largest city, Yangon, as well as the city of Manila, demanding their civilian leaders be reinstated. They also want the release of de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other officials from detention. The majority of demonstrators were students and doctors. A separate demonstration was held in Yangon in support of junta leaders. Pro-coup protesters wielding knives and slingshots clashed with residents. Myanmar's junta seized power on February the 1st. They alleged fraud in the November elections in which Suu Kyi's party won against a pro-military party. The Electoral Commission was dismissed, rather has dismissed the fraud complaints. And a U.S. warship has once again sailed through the Taiwan Strait despite repeated warnings and criticism from China. A Chinese military spokesman accused the U.S. of undermining regional peace and stability. That's after the military tracked the USS Curtis Wilbur near its waters on Wednesday. The U.S. Navy said the destroyer made a routine Taiwan Strait transit. Beijing considers self-ruled Taiwan as part of its territory. It has long accused the U.S. of interfering in its internal affairs by acting as Taiwan's main international backer and weapons supplier. Beijing has also recently called for a reset in China-U.S. ties following the departure of Donald Trump. Ties sank to their lowest over a host of issues, including trade, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the South China Sea. Chinese political researcher Qin Dozhu says Washington tends to play the Taiwan chord more when it wants to increase pressure on China.
If you look at the Taiwan issue, you know, Taiwan is part of China. Basically, every country in the world recognized that fact, including the United States. Remember, the U.S. has an informal relationship with Taiwan. And secondly, despite the fact that Washington has been playing Taiwan as a card against Beijing, when the relationship between Washington and Beijing is getting worse, in particular over the past 4 years under the Trump regime, so you can see more high-level official visit from Washington to Taipei and more selling of weapons to Taipei. So that's, when the relationship between Beijing and Washington is getting, more tense, and then you see Washington will play the card of Taiwan more and play it harder. So this is the case. You know, they are sending their warships crossing this Taiwan Strait over there. And thirdly, remember, the U.S. has becoming a force here, a destabilizing force in this region. The U.S. is becoming a force to instigate instability across the Taiwan Strait.
The United States says it will soon release an intelligence report on the 2018 murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki made the announcement. She added that U.S. President Joe Biden is also expected to speak with Saudi Arabia's King Salman. Reports say Khashoggi's murder will be a hot topic during the phone conversation. The declassified document reportedly implies that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was involved in the journalist's murder. Khashoggi was a Washington Post columnist and a fierce critic of Saudi government policies. He was assassinated by Saudi agents at the country's consulate in Istanbul on October 2018. Political commentator William Beeman says former U.S. President Donald Trump concealed the documents on the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
The Khashoggi murder is a scandal, and it has been hidden by the Trump administration. That is, all of the documentation that was collected was suppressed by the Trump administration, largely because of the personal and, I should say, commercial relationship between Donald Trump and Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. Now the Biden administration has come into power, and this documentation will now be unclassified. We're waiting for the documentation to actually be declassified. Avril Haines would be the one to do this, and Ms. Haines has promised to declassify this material as soon as possible. But we know quite a lot about this assassination, and I think that there's general consensus that Mohammed bin Salman was involved in this at some level.
The German government has agreed to extend the presence of the country's troops in Afghanistan till the end of January 2020. Berlin says the extension will make it possible for the NATO member nation to react to what it called changes in the volatile security and threat situation in Afghanistan. The cabinet's decision now requires the approval of the lower house of parliament. Last week, NATO said it had made no final decision on withdrawing its troops from Afghanistan. In February last year, Washington and the Taliban agreed that the U.S. withdraw its troops from Afghanistan by May 2021 in return for security guarantees from the militants. The new U.S. administration has, however, said it would review the deal, accusing the militants of not meeting their commitment to reduce violence. The head of Iranian Judiciary's High Council for Human Rights says U.S. sanctions have grossly violated the absolute rights of Iranian people to have access to humanitarian aid.
I speak of a nation whose absolute right, including the right to health, the right to food, the right of access to humanitarian aid, and the right of access to peaceful nuclear technology, have been grossly violated by the illegal sanctions imposed by the U.S. regime and its implementations by a number of Western countries.
Ali Baghdadi Kani was speaking in a high-level session of the Human Rights Council in Geneva. He noted that sanctions have even deprived Iran of purchasing medicines for children suffering from butterfly disease. Baghdadi Kani said the so-called maximum pressure campaign launched by the former U.S. administration has led to the maximum violation of the rights of Iranians. He slammed as politically motivated the claims of human rights violations made by some Western countries against Iran. Further in his remarks, Baghdadi Kani lashed out at the U.S. and Israel for assassinating the country's top general Qasem Soleimani and nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. He said such murders show that Iran pays the price for fighting terrorism.
The assassination of the greatest defender of the right of nations in the region against terrorism, General Qasem Soleimani, by the U.S. regime, and the assassination of our scientists of the field of peaceful nuclear science and technology, including martyr Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, by the Zionist regime, are but a portion of expenses paid by the Iranian people in the fight against terrorism.
Baghdadi Kani further said Iran has been at the forefront of the fight against terrorism. He added that some Western countries have praised the notorious anti-Tehran terror group MKO, which has killed thousands of innocent people. Elsewhere, nearly 1.5 million people in the U.S. state of Texas are still without drinking water more than a week after winter storms wreaked havoc on the state's power grid and water facilities. More than 20,000 people were completely without running water Wednesday because of water main breaks, mechanical failures, frozen or broken water pipes, or other issues. Experts estimate the damage from the storm will cost billions. Thousands of Texans are facing damage from burst pipes, which have flooded homes. This problem is especially rampant in multi-story apartments, where it can be more difficult to fix problems soon. Several southern and central U.S. states witnessed an unprecedented cold blast this month. However, Texas has by far been the hardest hit. Ukraine's health ministry has reported a nearly 40% jump in the number of new daily coronavirus cases. The country registered more than 8,000 infections in 24 hours, the highest daily figure since mid-January. Data shows that most of the new cases are found either in the capital, Kiev, or in the western parts of the country. The new spike comes amid the start of the vaccination campaign in Ukraine. Elsewhere in Europe, Germany's Robert Koch Institute announced nearly 12,000 new COVID cases and 385 more deaths. That brings the country's total caseload to over 2,400,000. Nearly 70,000 people have lost their lives in Germany since the start of the pandemic. And Iran's Bayatollah University has unveiled the latest scientific achievements made by its affiliate firms in the fight against the COVID-19 pandemic. The university has turned into a major research and development center since the virus broke out in Iran. Yusuf Jalali reports.
This is a specialized meeting on the latest studies on the coronavirus, organized and hosted by Bayatollah University, the event brought together epidemiologists, virologists, and other medical experts to present their team's latest findings on prevention and treatment of COVID-19.
We tried the so-called plasmapheresis in treating COVID-19 patients. What is plasmapheresis? It's a method of removing blood plasma from the body and re-injecting it into the bloodstream. We conducted this method on 28 COVID patients and it was effective so far. We need to gather a large sample to achieve more reliable results.
We conducted a single-centered retrospective observational study of 60 laboratory-confirmed COVID patients and administered low-dose prednisolone in combination with naproxen and lopinavir. This helped reduce the length of patients' hospitalization.
Since the pandemic broke out in Iran, Baghiyatullah University has dedicated its R&D centers to COVID-related projects. So far, it has launched 200 research projects that seek to find a way to tackle the pandemic. Among them is a recombinant-based COVID vaccine that is making its way to the human trial phase.
We are wrapping up the animal trial stage and will soon begin the human trials of our vaccine. Our university has become a hotspot of major projects that center on COVID-19. We were amongst the first center that proposed plasma therapy for COVID-19. We're also conducting research on stem cell therapy and other viable treatments for the novel disease.
With the Baghiyatullah vaccine, Iran now possesses three viable candidates that have made their way to the human trial: COVPARS, which is a recombinant vaccine, and COVIran, which works based on a weakened coronavirus. This, as Iran has already started its mass inoculation program using Russia's Sputnik V.
Baghiyatullah Hospital has since day one been one of the most active places in the fight against COVID-19. Now, as many biotech firms are concentrating their efforts on prevention and vaccine development, this center has also paid attention to treatment. Researchers here say they're very close to an effective COVID medicine. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Turkish main opposition party continues to question former Treasury and Finance Minister Berat Albayrak, who's also President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's son-in-law over the Central Bank Reserve. Erdogan says the campaign is targeting his families and their fundamental rights and freedoms. Rashan Sagan reports from Istanbul.
Head of Turkey's main opposition party, CHP, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, questioned the fate of $128 billion during the era of former Treasury and Finance Minister Berat Albayrak, who is also the president's son-in-law, adding that the fate of both those billions and the minister are still unknown. The main opposition also questions the whereabouts of the former minister following his disappearance from the public eye after his resignation in November 2020. Erdogan emphasized that the transactions over the central bank's reserves were carried out in accordance with the regulation.
Erdogan says that his son-in-law was very successful in office. So why did he resign from his post and disappear in this suspicious way? Once again, I address the question to President Erdogan that what has happened to the $128 billion of the central bank reserve? And why did the finance minister disappear?
Erdogan defended Albayrak as an energy minister and finance minister, saying that the reason for criticism towards Albayrak was because he was not a politician.
The resignation of former finance minister took place months ago, but the opposition continues to question the reasons behind it, and I think the issue should be viewed as part of the upcoming elections campaign.
Albayrak's abrupt resignation and his disappearance were interpreted as the government's effort to blame him for the recent financial problems the country is facing. Many also say that his father-in-law wanted him to play low-key in the meantime, for he is preparing for the 2023 elections. Observers say the resignation of Albayrak has already inflicted a heavy blow to Turkish president, and it seems that the issue could gain momentum as Turkey gets closer to the next elections. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Democracy, directed by Swiss filmmaker David Burnett. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is John Rees, who is a writer, broadcaster, and author. Now, Democracy is a documentary that gives you an amazing insight into the legislative process at EU level, offering a compelling story about a handful of politicians trying to protect society in the digital world from the dangers of big data and mass surveillance. And following 2 long years full of pitfalls and accelerated by the upheaval of the Snowden affair, parliamentarian Jan-Philipp Albrecht and European Commissioner Viviane Reding worked together for a new law on the protection of personal data.
Many people say data is the new oil, the oil of the 21st century. If you think about how oil has transformed our lives, data is going to do the same thing.
Das wäre der Knoten meines Lebens. Wenn ich da als Minister sitzen würde, würde ich auch jemanden zuhören, der keine Krawatte trägt. Es geht darum, dass sie eine Datenschutzverordnung verabschieden sollen.
Data protection is a fundamental right, and the companies have the duty to explain what they do with our data.
European citizens are concerned that their personal data may be misused.
That causes jobs to leave the European Union.
Our life is about data. Data are money.
Surveillance is about managing populations, managing people.
That's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy.
It is our responsibility to get these rights in place.
Who do you think would like to stop the direct?
Well, I think we know the usual suspects.
Well, first of all, warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for coming on. So this documentary tackles an important issue of our time and gets behind the scenes of the European privacy debate. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Democracy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, fascinating and important subject, but for me, sadly, deeply unpersuasive treatment. I mean, it's by nature, you know, if you're going to follow lots of bureaucratic meetings with people kind of, you know, arguing over very, minutiae of clauses and things like that, there needs to be something to grip an audience. And, you know, first of all, it's filmed in this kind of very kind of nondescript greyish black and white. But I guess the director would say he's probably trying to avoid sensationalism or dumbing down.
Well, some critics have actually praised the film and its efforts and its monochrome sort of sequences and the black and white feel to it. Because it is an incredibly tough subject to film and follow through. Perhaps the director made it, for new audiences, watchable, given it's a tough subject.
If people get something out of it, that's great. All I can talk to is my experience of it. And I do think this is an issue that, because it sounds quite boring, people do switch off. And I think, unless you're preaching to the converted, if you want more people to be engaged in this issue and you want them to sort of sit up and take notice, you need to get their attention.
Just to bring in John here. John, are we as a society largely ignorant about data protection issues? So surely this film can help persuade people of this argument.
Well, it'd leave people going away with the idea, maybe I must find out what it's about. And also the critical thing you see here is what happens when corporations that are privately assembling data for consumer management, which is one issue, an important issue, flips over into state access to that data. And that's what the Snowden case, of course, revealed. And that's
the
only
picking up on that.
Yeah, and that's the only time when the film really kicks off.
Ladies and gentlemen, the citizens are very worried. 72% of European citizens are concerned that their personal data may be misused. Our reform will assure a high protection to the individuals. A single set of European rules on data protection, fit for the digital age, valid everywhere across the European Union, on the basis that the personal data belongs to the person.
When I became Commissioner for Justice and responsible for the protection of the citizens, I knew at that moment I had to reform the data protection rules. Without trust, no digital economy. So it is in the own interest of the politicians who want to develop our economy and of the industry who wants to take advantage of the personal data of the individuals, that clear rules are established so that citizens know, all right, I can hand out my data. That is exactly what we need. Because in this new digital world, no service can function without the data. The data are needed.
So that was the importance of data protection. Lee, what else does this film tell us about the significance of data protection? What arguments does it make, and why is it so controversial?
Well, all the arguments that Viviane Reding makes and Jan-Philipp Albrecht, they're all absolutely valid, and they're things that we should be concerned about. But I would question one of the things she says there. She says, without trust, no digital economy. Now, the fact is, a lot of people, as they say, don't trust it, but actually, we all are kind of complicit because we so easily give our consent and agree to things and share our details that actually the digital economy seems to be doing quite well. And the issue is, why are we so pliant and why do we give our consent so easily? And this is the thing. A film like this or anything that discusses this, whether it's a news program or a documentary, should be trying to alert us and give concrete examples of what is happening with this data and why we should be more concerned.
Surely this is a testament to the documentary then. It's just simply following sort of the bureaucratic process and that bringing to light and to this issue to the public eye, whereas we would otherwise not know about these issues.
Well, again, I think its heart is in the right place. It wants to do that. I just don't believe it does. What this does is follow very diligently and, obviously taking a long time, the trail, the process of getting these laws applied.
So, John, for viewers who haven't seen this documentary, could you help contextualise this issue of data protection? Why is it such a huge issue?
Well, what for the first time in history you've got is major corporations being able to track, not by name, and that's important, but in general patterns, consumer behaviour at quite a detailed level. And there's a question mark about whether or not that should be, the degree to which that should be able to be done, and certainly able to be done without consent. And that's an important issue. But, and I have to say, that clip is very revealing although the filmmaker doesn't make very much of it, because the film is framed as if it's a battle of, you know, kind of libertarians against the power of the corporations. But that's not what the EU does. And in fact, what the EU does is it excludes cowboy capitalism so that the really big guys can agree on the rules and compete on that basis. That's what it does for the European area.
So who else can we rely on then to ensure that these checks and balances
well,
are in
coming,
place?
Well, we're coming to that, because the people who are actually the heroes of this story and the person who ignites this film is Edward Snowden. Mm-hmm. And those are the people who should, you know, Jan-Philipp Albrecht, all right, nice guy, green, trying to do his best, thinks the EU is a marvellous institution, wants the corporations to behave reasonably, fair enough. But that isn't really the person that smashes open this whole debate, even in this film. And he's supposed to be the hero of this film.
Interesting point you made, and we'll touch on Snowden again, as I mentioned, a bit later on. And Lee, if I could just quickly ask you, what were some of the obstacles that Jan faced then in trying new lobbying efforts?
Well, I mean, you know, this basic assumption that citizens are consumers and therefore we should be treated as such. It's like, therefore, you know, what's wrong? We're going to give you what you want. This is a shortcut. If we know, you know, the things that you're interested in and where, you know, what your daily existence is about, we can help facilitate that. Now, obviously, that's a very positive spin on that. The downside is, you know, it's about commerce and it's about selling things to people. And unfortunately, the kind of the positive benefits seem to get easily swept aside in the rush to kind of make sales.
I think everybody is aware that the lobby on this file is one of the most intensive that we've seen for a long time.
This has been the most heavily lobbied piece of legislation in recent years. Why is it causing so much stir and interest?
It is important to understand that European companies are a major part of this growing internet economy. Some of the most successful global internet companies to date are European.
The conflicts between big giant internet companies and the rights of the individual in terms of protecting their data online. What were some of the conflicts, if you could shed more light on that, between these companies and data protection?
Well, I mean, aside from the whole commercial angle, there's the surveillance side of things, and the idea that if, as John was talking about, if the companies share this information with the state, what use is that information going to be put to? So in the UK, you know, famously, the sort of Snoopers Charter that came, you know, was announced November 2016 is maybe hopefully going to be...
It was passed into law last year.
Yeah, exactly.
Also known as the Snoopers Charter.
Yeah, exactly. So that whole idea is if you get, someone in charge, I mean, the US is perhaps a good example, who looks like they're cracking down on kind of, you know, freedom of information and things, then maybe that information is going to be misused. And this is a big worry for people. It's like, if you can pinpoint, maybe without specific names, but, you know, being able to identify people by so many characteristics, where's this going to go? Mm-hmm. And if you're allowing this stage of, you know, gradual sort of erosion, then, you know, it's open to abuse in the future.
And John, so this film implies that giant internet companies such as Google, Microsoft, Facebook, etc., Yahoo, for example, that they have invested interest in data, against data protection. They don't like to be associated with these sorts of laws and things. Why do you think that is the case?
Well, I think every capitalist corporation just wants as much freedom as possible to gather as much information about its customers as possible and use it how it likes without legal regulation, transparency or oversight. I think that's a kind of given. And not just in this industry, by the way, but right across the board. I mean, big corporations are some of the most secretive bodies in our society. I mean, probably only the state secret service agencies are more secretive than giant oil companies or giant car companies. And, of course, industrial espionage is a thing. So, you know, I think we have to take that as one of the ways in which a competitive profit-seeking system works. That's what they want. That's what they want it to do.
So, how can an individual, take on sort of a giant corporation like that?
You can't as an individual. The imbalance in power is too great. That's why they are collective powerful collective entities, and if you're going to take them on, you need powerful collective entities on your side as well. Mass protest movements, trade union organisations, labour organisations, that's why that kind of.
But why don't we see this then? Do you think there's an ignorance then on the public's part?
No, I do think that, and this film kind of underlined this. Yes, there's massive corporate lobbying going on. I think at one point in the film they say 96% of the lobbying that took place over this piece of legislation was from corporations and their various front organisations. And that's an interesting thing, because that will be happening not just on this bill, but on every conceivable piece of Labour legislation that you can think about. I think people are concerned about that. We heard the figures, but you know, there are some things that are a lot closer to home than whether or not Google has got your consumer preferences. Your health service, your wages, your welfare provision, these are things that are cutting into people's lives like right now and matter about fundamental things in their lives. If huge corporations get your data, perhaps they'll missell you things, perhaps they'll try and sell you things you don't want and have things about you don't know about, and that's bad. But corporations don't have the power to arrest you, try you, imprison you, deport you. That's what the state can do. And so when the state has these powers, this is a holy order different threat. And I think we've seen that the reaction to these two things by the public is different as well, because they understand that distinction.
Mm-hmm. So more sinister issues beneath the surface then. Mm.
Edward Snowden revealed that secret surveillance activities went far beyond what anyone thought possible.
Companies like Google, Facebook, Apple, and Microsoft got together with the NSA and provided direct access to the back ends of all communicating systems.
I think that the public is owed an explanation of the motivations behind the people who make these disclosures. That's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy.
The Guardian's editor-in-chief testified before Parliament that only a fraction of the leaked files have been revealed.
It's about 1% of what we were given.
Only 1% of the information in those files has now gone public.
Yes.
The EU Justice Commissioner has spoken about the leaks from Edward Snowden and says that new legislation must be put in place to protect the privacy of EU citizens.
Anybody who uses digital equipment is put under some form of surveillance. And that seems to me is something which cannot happen without consent. It cannot happen without the consent of populations. So my message to the lawmakers is, please protect us.
What's the strength of this documentary Democracy, I think, is that it gives you an insight into the privacy battle before and after the Snowden revelations. So you sort of see that journey and struggle. Lee, how was the revelations a game changer, and did it make the EU go into more gear and make more progress?
I mean, funnily enough, the appearance of Snowden in the film mirrors his kind of, you know, explosion and effect in real life. It kind of jump starts, makes it personal, gives you a concrete example, and actually helps you understand and get a grip on something else. The impression the film gives is that that gives a new impetus to their fight. It gives something concrete, and they can point to that example of Snowden and say, you see, this is the sort of thing we're talking about. If this can happen in this case, it can also happen in these other cases, and therefore that's why our, you know, this issue is so prevalent. And I, you know, the film at least gives the impression that that helps win the argument that they're putting forward.
So finally, we get to discuss all the Snowden revelations now in this part of the show. John, what did you make of the revelations, and was it a game changer for the EU and sort of the battle for privacy?
Yeah, I think Lee's absolutely right about this. I mean, it was a game changer, along with others, Chelsea Manning, WikiLeaks, and so forth and so on. But that's the point, really. These are things that come from the heart of the surveillance state, and they're very, very shocking. And they have a political effect about, you know, this doesn't come out in the film, and it should do, but they're about real things happening, about people losing their lives with illegal operations in Afghanistan and so forth and so on, about the treatment of prisoners by the United States and so forth. These are deeply important issues which did have a political effect, and they're about surveillance by the state. And this film doesn't really acknowledge quite what a big shift this is. It says it's a game changer in terms of their legislation, but we've suddenly moved from a film which is only discussing kind of corporate interest in data collection to the question of the state, and it's not surprising to me that that's where the film really becomes interesting. If this film had been 25 minutes long, the last 25 minutes of what impact did Edward Snowden have on privacy legislation going to the EU, that would have been quite an interesting, and it is actually quite an interesting documentary. So yeah, it changes gear, but it changes political focus and doesn't really quite acknowledge that it's doing that or why that might be important.
I just wanted to read an example now of Snowden. One of his revelations is that the NSA and the GCHQ here in the UK have far-reaching powers, particularly this country, that undermine privacy and security, variety of means, so unlocking encryption used to protect emails, for example, banking and medical records. And what's also controversial, which the film mentions, is that, you know, why should the US have the power and jurisdiction to spy on people in Europe? So one of the leaks that Snowden revealed was that an average of 3 million data intercepts per day in France, with peaks of almost 7 million in around 2012 and 2013 occurred. So this is the magnitude is just unsort of believable, really. So, and surely that having the EU in place can help buffer sort of and protect us from sort of the US spying from us.
Yeah, interestingly though, we're never told in the documentary to what degree the law that they're passing actually affects the relations between private corporations and the state and between individual. I'm not even clear at the end of this whether or not that legislation applies to state bodies or not. Now that would have been an interesting thing to know, and to what degree, and do they avoid them, and so on and so forth. I mean, there's also a whole series of issues about the mistakes that the state system makes, because actually it can't process, it can mass data observe, but to get that down to so-and-so did so-and-so and is guilty of such-and-such is a very hard task, and the state often is misled and injustices and miscarriages of justice arrive because it can't actually process this degree of raw data.
But so it seems like an illusion of power at this stage, and also than the capacity to follow through.
Yeah.
And Lee, if I could ask you sort of your personal thoughts on your data and how it's being used, did this film make you think and more sort of paranoid in any way, or aware of how your data is being used?
Yeah, I mean, you know, truth be told, I'm so aware of it already. You know, you go onto a social media site, you're getting an advert for something you looked at maybe on a different computer 3 weeks ago, just once. That is alarming to me. I got a new phone, I parked my car, I went off somewhere, like a message came up saying, show me where my car was parked. Now, if someone else got hold of my phone, they would just have immediate access. It's obviously trying to do me a favour. Mm-hmm. Say, here's where your car is. Hopefully I would remember that, and maybe there'd be so you go out on a night and you forget where your car is, and it's a useful thing. But you're just so aware of this sort of network that's operating and, you know, able to kind of track and log and all this kind of stuff. So I have to say, sadly, this film didn't really do anything about that. And I think what John says is very right. This change from corporate to state thing, the state thing is the real worry. I mean, the corporation stuff, definitely, you know, I have issues with. But they almost piggyback on Snowden to give themselves a sort of, you know, third act lift. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily tie in together. But it is also doing a service, because there's nothing about the issues that this film tackles that I would disagree with. It's more just the handling of it and, you know, persuading more people to kind of pay attention. I don't think this film quite does it.
And so, John, just your final thoughts on the film now.
Well, I mean, I'd be interested in a kind of 10-minute sequel, because this piece of legislation passed. We all know that, as Lee's just said, this stuff is still happening to us at an exponentially growing rate. So exactly how effective was, after that long battle, after we've watched all this, how effective really, really was it?
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambiati.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام اعلم أنه لا علم كطلب السلامة ولا سلامة كسلامة القلب.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "Know that there is no knowledge like the quest for integrity, and there is no integrity better than the integrity of the heart."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. When talking about these beautiful conversations and these beautiful dialogues in the lives of the infallible imams, these divinely appointed imams, in the progeny of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, we find that in the life of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, Imam Muhammad bin Ali, we see that there are many beautiful conversations and dialogues in his life. Of course, Imam al-Baqir and Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq had an ample opportunity to be able to have conversations with different people. In one such conversation in the life of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, we find that he says to his companion, "Allah says, O son of Adam, Adam, refrain from what I have prohibited, so that you are the most pious of all people." It is interesting, dear friends, but at times we try to look for some kind of secret or a shortcut towards piety, towards this taqwa, or God consciousness, in other words. So we say God consciousness because when you are conscious and you are aware of the presence and the existence of Allah, then you start to become pious, because when you are aware of Allah's all-encompassing and all the time presence, then you feel that you need to do all of the wajibat, and you need to refrain from the muharramat. Wajibat meaning those things which are religiously obligatory upon us, and muharramat those things which are religiously prohibited for us. And so Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam here says that the most pious of all people, the people with the most taqwa, the people with the most God consciousness, this awareness of Allah, are those who refrain from what is prohibited. They refrain from things that are haram. And so, dear friends, if we too want to be among the muttaqeen, the ones who are pious, then we must try our very best to refrain from what is prohibited. Beautiful words in this dialogue between a companion and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Finally, the priest says, I'm going to ask you a question which I am sure you do not have the answer for. Imam says, go ahead, ask. The priest says, tell me of two people who were born on the same day. They are twins. Yes, they are brothers. They are born on the same day and they both died at the same day. But one of them died at the age of 50 and the other died at the age of 150. Imam alayhi salam says, this is Uzair and his brother Azra. They were both born on the same day, but Uzair, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made him sleep for 100 years, where it was a test for him and a sign of the power and the majesty of the Almighty subhanahu wa ta'ala, where he passed by a village where he recognized and he saw that people had died, and he asked, how are these people resurrected on the day of judgment? فَأَمَاتَهُ اللَّهُ مِئَةَ عَامٍ. Allah made him go through death for 100 years, ثُمَّ بَعَثَهُ, then gave him life. When he immediately returned back to life after 100 years, he saw that his donkey that was with him was completely disintegrated, only bones had left, but he saw that the food was still fresh, and Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala returned back the donkey for him to note how there will be resurrection on the day of judgment. That priest, when he heard the answer, Imam al-Baqir stood up. He was fuming with anger, shouted at the people and said, it is all your fault. How can you do this? I will never see you for the next 12 months. And he stormed out. And the narration tells us he thought that it is them, the people who have brought Imam al-Baqir to debate him. This was a characteristic of the life of the Imam alayhi salam, as well as the 6th holy Imam, 8th holy Imam too.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.